Many people in our food community have been seriously impacted by Superstorm Sandy, and our hearts go out to them. At HRN, we've been covering these stories since the storm hit. To learn more, visit our website at www.heritageradionetwork.org. Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning, everybody, or good afternoon. Good morning to the people we're going to be talking to. This is Patrick Martins from The Main Course, and we just came back from a very busy weekend of basically packing about 3,000 turkeys, which went to various homes around the country for Thanksgiving. So fresh turkeys sent in FedEx boxes, sent in boxes via FedEx, and it was really, really cool because the FedEx people allowed us to work within their facility in Moonaki, New Jersey, right next to the Meadowlands. So we got full access to their, rolling tables and employees that helped us pallet wrap and scan all the birds, and it was really, really awesome that they helped us like that. And while we were doing that, a team of 10 of us here in New Jersey, then there was also a group of about 20 in Kansas City doing the same thing for turkeys going to people in the Midwest and the West Coast. So this Tuesday, everyone will be getting their turkeys. It was a kind of crazy year for Good Shepherd Turkey Ranch, the only farm in America allowed to use the word heritage on their turkey label, on their USDA bug, actually. And they brought in about 10,000 turkeys to be slaughtered, but only got about 6,000 out. And that's a 40% failure rate for whole birds. And the most normal rate is like 10-15% at worst. I mean, his turkeys being so healthy should be 2%. And yet it just goes to show you the horrible slaughterhouse they had up in Omaha, I believe, Nebraska, or Gibbon, Nebraska. And then also the failure of the USDA inspectors at that plant to understand the contours and genetic makeup of heritage birds, which do not look like traditional birds. They have longer breasts and a little pinkish hue, purple hue almost to their breasts, so which is the way natural turkeys are. It's just the commodity birds have lost that natural trait. So, you know, very tough. He ended up getting all these pieces from the nicked wings and ground and breasts, bone and breasts and this and that. So he's going to have a real challenge to sell all that stuff in the coming months. And we hope everyone supports him and supports us helping him trying to sell all those cuts that he's been forced to live with because of bad slaughter. But on the positive side, everyone who ordered a turkey from us is going to get their turkey. And Thanksgiving is such a fun, non-denominational holiday. Everyone celebrates it. And everyone gets off and eats like a pig. And it's, you know, seconds and thirds and goes back for sandwiches. So pretty exciting time of the year and a good time for heritage foods for sure. And we're going to kind of be talking about turkey and Thanksgiving. Interesting places with our two guests who are calling from different places. So we're going to be talking to Scott Roberts in a second, and he is the author of The Salt Lick Cookbook, A Story of Land, Family, and Love, which he wrote with Jessica Dupuy. And it was very awesome because my brother-in-law, Bill, and his fiance, Megan, are getting their wedding catered by the Salt Lick barbecue joint, this awesome place that I've been to about a dozen times. Really, really love it. And then later we're going to talk to Simone at Cleaver and Company, a new butcher shop in New Orleans that bought a bunch of heritage turkeys. So anyway, I'm very excited about the show. I think Joe told me that he already has Scott on the line. Scott, are you with us?
Yes, yes.
Hey, how are you? Thanks so much for calling, waking up early and calling in from Texas.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. Well, an honor to be on your show.
Yes, well, it is an honor to be talking to you. I mean, you heard what a small world it is. I got this book, and I was like, went to my brother-in-law and was like, check this out. And they were like, what? It was very, very interesting. Now, where are we calling you? In Austin, or where?
Yeah, I'm in Austin at the moment.
All right, very good. And, of course, you're a legendary, really part of Texas lore, barbecue restaurant is, what, 30 minutes away from Austin?
Yeah, about 20, 30 minutes, depending on the traffic.
All right, depending on the traffic. And it is a huge place, right? I mean, how many people can you seat there at any one time?
Oh, theoretically, we can seat about 800 people.
800 people. Wow. So there's a lot of food being produced. It's outside of the hustle and bustle of downtown Austin, and yet it is a real institution, and you can tell what an amazing place it is by the quality of this cookbook. I mean, it is just a beautiful, beautiful hardcover cookbook that is coming out on the 21st. And, you know, I have so many questions. So just to begin, tell us about the famous pit. You know, it's history, what makes it work so well, and, you know, what is its, you know, what's its secret? What's its schedule, you know?
The history of the pit is that my relatives, excuse me, came from the Southeast after the Civil War. About half the population left the Southeast and moved to the New Frontier, which was Texas back then, and they were part of that migration. And the pit is basically how they would cook when they were traveling. You know, on the wagons and stuff, and so they would stop and, you know, build a fire, and they had some metal grates, and they'd get rocks to suspend the grates, and they'd sear the meats on the fire, and then they'd move them away and put coals and kind of do indirect cooking. And the if the wind was blowing from one direction too much, they'd put an earthen berm around that edge to hold the heat and smoke in, as they said. And so the pit that you see on the front cover of the book is a simulation of that, I guess, is the way to say it. You see the open fire, mm-hmm. You see the grill, and then the rock wall is the earthen berm that holds the heat and smoke in. And the way it came about is my father just loved being in Driftwood, Texas, where he was born. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, the restaurant is on a tract of land that my family's owned since 1902 that my grandparents bought and he was born on and grew up there. And he wanted just to live there, so one day he took me and another man. I was about 16 years old, but he took us down to this spot on the ranch and near the road, 1826, and he got out of his truck and he made a mark in the ground with the heel of his boot. Then he went back to the truck and got his barbecue fork and came back and made another mark, and so that pit is sized so that he could reach the center of it. Mm-hmm. And he had me and Loopy was the other guy go get rocks from off the place and sand from the creek and make mortar, and we built that, Loopy and I built that pit that you see there, the rock deal. Then we cut the cedar down between it and the road, and then we laid the fence down, pulled the fence back, and he would go down there with cotton, sleep and cook meats and sell to people that just pulled up off the side of the road. And then one of his friends asked him to put a picnic table. And so he did, and then the next thing you know, we were getting gravel from the creek, and we poured a floor around the pit, and then we built walls around it, except for one side was a wood wall, because he knew it was going to be successful and would expand it. Mm-hmm. And that's how the restaurant got started, and then everything that we've built since then has just been in response to more and more people coming, and, you know, so we had to build more and more buildings.
So interesting. So, I mean, how far do you trace this kind of, you know, cooking in the outdoors, you know, how far do you trace that back?
It was taught to him by his, you know, parents, and it was just handed down in the family. So I guess, you know, back to the 1880s, 1870s.
Wow. And, well, I mean, that's very interesting. And why did he pick that spot? I mean, it was just a good spot.
Well,
it's far away, that's why I say.
It was actually a cotton field. Mm-hmm. And he and his sister would have to, you know, hoe rows of cotton, and there were so many rows they had to hoe before they could go get a drink of water. And the well where the restaurant is was where they got their drinks of water. And so that area just always had a good feel to him, so that's why he located the restaurant there.
Huh. And tell us what makes the taste of your barbecue different. You know, I was wondering if you were going to, in your book, you know, I wonder what you would answer. And it, you talk a lot about the land and the people, you know, making it so important. And if you could speak to that. And also gastronomically, you know, your barbecue is so famous. Like, how does it differ from other barbecues in Texas or around the country?
Well, you know, the land and the people is... Any dish is just as good as the person that makes it. You know, if you care about something, you can make a great dish. If you don't care about it, I don't care what the recipe is, it's not going to be that good. So that's one of the things that goes into the barbecue, is that my father and his family and all of our employees who I hope you saw the picture of our secret ingredient, which is our employees.
I did.
And... We all care about how it's done. Now, gastronomically, our barbecue sauce is actually a southeastern barbecue sauce. You know, it came from South Carolina and Georgia. Mm-hmm. They brought it over, and it's been, we say it's been Texified. It, I'm sure when it left South Carolina, it didn't have chili dulce or cayenne pepper in it. Mm-hmm. So it picked up those kind of things. But the one thing it didn't pick up, it has no tomatoes in it.
Okay.
And it's high. And it's acidic, and it has a high sugar content. And what happens when it's finished on those open pits, the radiant heat and the smoke actually caramelizes on the outside of the meats, and that gives it one flavor profile. And the other flavor profile that pit adds is there's two others. We soak pecan hulls in water like other people do hickory chips, and then we throw them onto the coals to control flare-ups, but we also put them on because the pecan hulls give the pecan wood smoke flavor to the meat. And then the other thing that happens is sometimes the sauce drips and falls directly on the coals, and then you get this flare-up, and the smoke comes back up, and that's actually a different kind of smoke, and that inflates the last flavor profile. And I think it's those three things that make our barbecue different than other things.
Very, very interesting. And now, what's the temperature get to on that open system?
Well, if you notice that, if you look at the pit, it varies from right over the fire. Mm-hmm. We can get it up to around 325.
Okay.
And then as you move away from the fire, around the edge, it just, you know, it continuously goes down. And then around the edges, it runs around about 150, 160 degrees.
And I just see all the meats on here. I mean, you have about, if I recall correctly, there's, what, 6 or 8 options as the main course? The sausages, the brisket, the turkey, which we'll talk about in a little bit, the ribs. Just give us give our client, our listeners a little idea of the menu for them to wrap their head.
My father cooked beef brisket, pork ribs, and a sausage that's beef and pork. And that's the only three things that he cooked. Since then, we've added chicken, and turkey, which I think that if he knew we were doing that, he would roll over in his grave because he would never let chickens touch his grill. But we had so much, you know, requests from our customers for those items that we added it to the menu. And then I started doing beef ribs on Sundays just as a special. And then, to be honest with you, Bobby Flay came out, tried them, and said on television one time that the beef ribs with our spicy sauce was his favorite barbecue. And ever since then, because we've had so many requests, that we carry them all the time now.
Very interesting. Well, let's stick with the history a little bit. I mean, tell us a little bit about Thurman and Roxy.
Well, Roxy is my grandmother, Thurman's mother, and she was born in Driftwood. She's, you know, just loved Driftwood, and she installed that into my father, and he loved the area. And he was just a really hard-working, good man who liked to cook barbecue for groups and events, and then that turned into, you know, his final career. And my grandmother was a very nice lady, and she was the person that if you went to church and you wanted her to invite you over for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Because she was noted as a great cook, and she did everything fresh and natural and very simple. And allowed the taste of the natural ingredients to come out, mm-hmm. and she, you know, really cared about what she cooked and had pride in what she did, and gave that to my father.
So how many, you know so much about food, and you're a real gastronome. How did you compile all these recipes? Because, I mean, a lot of them are word of mouth. I mean, this is really a book. I mean, here, for our listeners, I'll make it drop on the table. You can hear. See, that's a real book. This is, I mean, how did you compile all these recipes? Because if you focus on such few things at the shop, I mean, obviously there's a lot more going on with you and food than just the few dishes at the Salt Lake.
Well, before the Salt Lake got started, my father, he was in the construction battalion during World War II. And after the war, he built bridges all over the state of Texas, and so he'd be gone most of the time. And we would live with my grandmother, and, you know, we were out in Driftwood back then. It was very far away from everything. And there were no other, the closest person to me and my brother's age lived maybe 6 or 7 miles away. So we were just with them, and she cooked a lot, and there wasn't anything else to do except to help her cook and do chores around the ranch. And so I guess that's where we picked it up. And she also made notes and left some of the recipes around, and, mm-hmm. and my mother was the same way. She's a very good cook, has a wonderful taste, and can season really good, and so she wrote some of the stuff down, and we just, you know, kind of just put it all together.
Very interesting. It must have been a very fun exercise. Beautiful pictures in this book as well. I really think it's a great, you know, coffee table book for anyone who loves barbecue or pictures of meat. So would you argue that the United States has a great gastronomy, just like China or France or Italy? Do you think the same traditions, quality of tradition exists in this country?
I think it does in places, you know. You know, we do have more, you know, fast foods, and we're always trying to copy somebody else. But if you've noticed, this movement to comfort foods and to slow cooking is coming about, and really, that's what my grandmother was all about, and that's the heritage that we have. You know, if you lived on a ranch and you raised your own food, then you prepared it, and you know, you just took pride in what you did because you had put so much effort into raising it to begin with, mm-hmm. and you kept it simple because a ripe tomato that comes straight off the vine, you know, there's just nothing that tastes better, you know, and or the wild watercress that used to grow on the ranch in the springs, it has its own flavor, and the cooks that I grew up with, all they did was enhance the flavors of the natural ingredients. So, yes, I think that America does have a culinary tradition.
And what is the ideal ingredient for you guys? I mean, obviously, being such a producer of food with so many people coming there day in and day out, I mean, I know it's impossible to support, you know, like the local organic farmer that raises 5 pigs. I mean, you're really buying large amounts of meats. Do you source from the same people? And what are the ideal qualities of the meat ingredients for your barbecue? Is it lean? Is it fat? You know, is it a certain breed?
It's we buy U.S. grade A choice. As a matter of fact, the briskets we buy are the top two-thirds of choice. And it's not really the breed, it's just the way that they were raised and fed. And we like larger briskets, and we're also getting a brisket that you don't normally get in the grocery stores. What you get in the grocery stores is a retail trim, and we get a packer's trim, which has a little bit more fat layers on the outside.
Okay.
And we feel that which cooks, you know, it cooks off as you're cooking. But what it does is it's a kind of a moisture barrier and helps hold the moisture of the brisket in. So that's one thing. And then we buy our pork ribs come from one supplier, and they're raised in the Midwest, and you know, they're grain fed. And honestly, on that, supposedly it's their specific genetics that they have too. So I believe on the pork, it is the breed, mm-hmm. and what they're fed.
Cool.
And then our sausage is made by the same place. We don't make our own sausage. We have a tradition of buying it from a producer about 90 miles from us, and we've been buying it from him for about 30 years.
30 years, wow, long time. And it's an interesting county. It's a dry county, right, that the Salt Lake
it
is
It was
in?
A dry county, and so that's where the tradition of letting people, you know, people bringing their own alcoholic beverages got started. Mm-hmm. The area is not dry anymore, but we still don't have licenses at the restaurant. We still keep the same tradition that my father started at the restaurant, so we don't sell them, but people can bring their own. And my daughter has opened a little wine tasting shop next to the restaurant because, you know, I told you earlier that where the Salt Lick is a cotton field, mm-hmm. and so it's actually been in continuous agricultural production by the Roberts family since 1902, and the last crop that we planted was vineyards, and so we were raising grapes and Seychelles wine.
Well, Texas is known for its wine. I know there are a lot of great wines in that state, even though a lot of people don't know that. Well, that's very interesting to see how that develops. So, of course, it's all you can eat. I mean, I still think I probably have some Salt Lick pumping through my system somehow from 6 months ago. But how many pounds does the average consumer consume?
I would say that the average they consume somewhere around a pound.
A pound of food?
It all averages out to about a pound. But, you know, some people eat a lot more than that. And the other thing, even though it's all you can eat, you know, we let you take your leftovers home.
Right, that's very nice. I was going to talk about that.
Go, you know, we just throw it away, so it would go to waste. And anyway.
For sure. And now the sides and the breads are very good. I mean, has that always been the constant tradition? I mean, your beans, the coleslaw.
Our coleslaw is really a vinegar and oil cabbage salad. Mm-hmm. And our potato salad is very simple. And again, it goes back to the original old times, because they didn't have much refrigeration. So they had cabbage, and they had potatoes, and they had onions, salt and pepper and vinegar. And basically that's all that our side dishes are.
Hmm.
They're very simple. They're meant to be consumed fresh and very quickly. As a matter of fact, even when we're really, really busy, we just make to order.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, you know, we don't let them. Our staff doesn't pre-make the coleslaw. They only make it when they run out,
mm-hmm.
and we just have a certain size of a tray. And when the tray gets down to a quarter, someone will make a new batch and put it out. And the same way with the potatoes.
Okay.
And they're very simple, but you know, being fresh, they just bring out the taste of the natural ingredients.
For sure, for sure. Well, not to upset your father, but let's talk turkey. What is your secret to turkey, and what does Salt Lick do for Thanksgiving?
Well, we close.
Okay.
We're closed on Thanksgiving. The only 2 days that we close are Thanksgiving and Christmas Day.
Okay.
We used to do smoked turkeys. We'd make about 250 in sale, but we haven't done that in the last couple of years because we used to get a turkey from the Amish area.
Okay.
And it's been hard to get them here lately, so we haven't been making any.
No turkey.
But what we have on the menu is a boneless turkey breast.
Okay.
And the secret to ours is that we brine it before we smoke it. And then we put the seasonings on and smoke it, and it stays extremely moist, but it takes on the smoked flavor.
Wow. Well, so interesting. I mean, I really have a thousand more questions I could ask. I just tried to ask 8 simple ones for this first time that you're on, but I know your book's about to come out. It is a beautiful book, everybody, and you're going to be able to link to how to buy it and where to buy it and the name of it and the publisher on our website, heritageradionetwork.org. It's Salt Lick Cookbook, A Story of Land, Family, and Love by Scott Roberts. And if ever you are in anywhere near Austin, take the pilgrimage, 2-4 hours, whatever it takes, visit the Salt Lick, because it's great barbecue, but it's just a lot of fun. It's a big space, ton of people, big food, bring a family, big group. It is just great. And I love that picture of the parking lot. I always remember, you know, it was always like a 5-minute walk back, and there are all these different zones of the restaurant. You know, it's almost like Central Park. You walk 5 feet, 10 feet, and there's a whole other section with tons of people. So it's a very fun restaurant, and thanks so much for giving us some time, Scott. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you, and really quickly, I'd like to thank Jessica and for helping me write it, and I'd like to thank Kenny. He's the photographer.
Oh, beautiful.
Fantastic job.
Yeah, no, the photography is why I say it's a great great coffee table book. I mean, he really brings out the color and the oils of the meats and everything, and he really captures the tradition of the place and the oldness of it. Yeah, it's a lovely book. Well, thanks again, Scott.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much.
All right, and we will take a break and come back with the folks of Cleaver and Company, a new animal to nose-to-tail butcher shop in New Orleans.
You're listening to Southern Pretender by Four Lincolns on heritageradionetwork.org.
The halls, this is something I've been through before. Not again. If our lives depend on it, so political. Analytical. Intellectual. Ineffectual. It's Southern Pretender, sister, mother, hide your children, ain't you under the pillow? Sleep on it, from a man in the white shoe.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Southern Pretender, sister, mother, it's all useless, and I want you. What you're going through, it's all figment of your imagination. Come on, baby, try to save me. Come on, baby, try to save me from the man in the white shoe.
All right, Simone, Seth, are you there?
Yes, we are.
All right. Did you hear the first part of the interview? That was so interesting. Scott Roberts, the Salt Lick Cookbook. It was like it's like having the governor of Texas on or something. It was like, that was a big interview. I was really excited. And now we go to everyone's favorite city in America, New Orleans. So, Simone and Seth, I know you guys opened one of the first, you know, true butcher shops in New Orleans. We'll talk about that in a sec, but to tie us in from our last interview, tell us about Thanksgiving and the tradition in New Orleans.
Well, Thanksgiving around New Orleans definitely centers a lot around family and almost like this sense of wanting to adopt everyone around you who has moved here, and you really want to kind of bring whoever you want to the Thanksgiving table. I mean, there have been so many times where I've been at my family's Thanksgiving and you turn around and you're like, who is that person? Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, this is the person that works at the grocery store where I go, and they didn't have anybody to be with. So they really, you know, we really try to bring as much family into it as possible.
Well, that's real interesting. And I mean, do New Orleans residents, I mean, they do turkey and cranberry sauce like everybody else? There's no special Creole or Cajun tradition?
Well, we did have somebody came as is doing a boudin rice dressing or a boudin dressing to go with their turkey instead of just cornbread dressing. So there are some people that bring some Cajun aspects into it as well.
Well,
yeah, and then I think the most predominant tradition is the next day when everyone makes their turkey gumbo.
Oh, yeah, okay. Using the leftovers, huh?
Yeah, you use the leftovers, you make your broth out of the carcass, all the nine yards.
Oh, fantastic. Well, tell us, guys, and congratulations about opening Cleaver and Company this past month. That's a big opening. I mean, how long had you been planning on it, and how was the opening couple weeks?
Well, we have been, Seth and I have been partners in planning this since that last November, but Seth has wanted to do this for 5+ years. And we met in grad school, and I love the idea. And I'm from Lafayette, which has meat markets everywhere. And I said, I would love to join with you and do this project. And so lots of planning, and we finally got open. And New Orleans has just been so receptive, because I think this is something that was really lacking here.
How is that? I mean, a place with so much tradition. I mean, there was no butchery energy in the city at all?
Well, it all kind of went away in the 50s and 60s when the supermarkets took over.
Okay.
You know, Schwegman's was a big player down here, and the supermarket was very popular and kind of pushed out all the neighborhood butcher shops. That's a tradition we're bringing back as we speak. And it's been amazing, the reception that we've got from the community so far, much more than we thought.
So tell us a little bit about what you guys do. Do you bring in whole pigs, whole sheep, whole cows? Tell us about what people would see if they came and visited.
Well, we buy the animals directly from the farmers, and all of our farmers are from within 200 miles of New Orleans, and we get in the whole animal. So we get in, right now we're getting in about a cow and two hogs a week.
Wow.
The whole animal. We break it down. We make house-made sausages. We just, our cooler right now is filled with everything from meatballs and meat pies to Italian sausage to bratwurst, andouille, beef broth. So we really utilize everything and waste as little as possible, because the whole animal can be used. We even have hogshead cheese. And I think New Orleans likes that. We just have a reach-in cooler, but there's no display case filled with steaks. You come in and it's, okay, you want a steak? We'll pull out the primal. How thick would you like it cut? And it's customized according to exactly what the customer wants.
Now, that's a crossover, because, I mean, the cutting of the animal and serving raw food is one thing, but the sausage making and all that is a value-added process that requires recipes and experience. So where did you learn your recipes, and are they traditional New Orleans recipes for those foods?
Oh, we have a mix of both. We have, you know, our lead butcher, Chris Dahl, has been amazing on the recipes that he's developed over, you know, a couple decades now. And he brought him to the shop for us, and has been doing amazing work. We also have one of our butchers is actually from Green Bay, so we're actually using some of those traditions and getting bratwurst and summer sausage made. And then our third butcher right now is Brandon. He's been doing some amazing work and just coming up with some new recipes and playing around with what ingredients we have right now and making sure that we use as much as possible. Because that's the secret to doing a whole animal butchery, is making sure you use every bit and as little goes out the door as possible. And that's how we can keep our prices good for the customers.
Well, was it a challenge to sell the shanks and all those kind of weird cuts like that? The hams, I know, are a pain in the butt a lot of times. I mean, what's been your secret to whole carcass utilization for those lesser cuts?
Yeah, I mean, the hams are still a problem, but thankfully we have have Christmas coming up. And we've got a curing fridge that we, you know, are taking advantage of that also. But it's been interesting, because, like, the first weekend we were open, we sold out of short ribs in, I think it was, like, midway through the second day.
Mm-hmm.
And then immediately we just say, oh, okay, but we have these shanks that are just as great. In fact, they're a little bit better because you get more marrow in there.
Which we know isn't true.
And,
no, just kidding. That's funny. It's like you're always like trying to sell the lesser cut as the best cut. I mean, we do that too at our little butcher shop at the Essex Market. It's always a challenge, and the people are like, "How do I prepare it?" And you know, it's a tough sell sometimes. But that's great.
Yeah,
that you guys can do it.
It's also easier when the shank is half the price of the short rib.
Right, for sure. So now,
in addition, Seth and I, you know, are foodies, and we're pretty good in the kitchen, and all of our guys, our butchers, also have culinary backgrounds and fine dining, and so they're really able to kind of help people. We, you know, we go out from behind the counter, and we talk to people, and we explain, you know, what they can do with them. Oh, you can braise this, or slow cook this, or here's a good recipe for this, and so I think people really like that, too. They're learning to think outside the box.
So where is Barone in relation to the rest of New Orleans?
Barone is uptown. We're about two blocks away from St. Charles, which is the streetcar line.
Okay.
We're a little away. We're about 3 miles from the 2 or 3 miles from the French Quarter. But if somebody was visiting town and they got on the streetcar, they could just get off and walk two blocks. And
yeah, we're pretty centrally located in the uptown neighborhood. So anyone who lives in uptown, it's pretty easy for them to get to us.
Now, I would have thought that New Orleans would be reluctant to embrace the sustainable food movement. I had a friend of mine, you know, a guy who was good to me, William Rice, was the wine and food writer for the Chicago Tribune. And I asked him, you know, why there wasn't more of a sustainable food movement in Chicago at the time. This was like 1998, 1999. And he said, because everyone in Chicago, when they know they're going out the weekend, they're thinking, what steak place are we going to go to? It's just their first thought, and it stays at that thought. And so, yeah, they're not going to go to that weird Ethiopian restaurant using all local organic produce as easily as other cities. So I would think much the same would be in New Orleans, like a kind of fear of an entrepreneur to start something new and, you know, be embraced by what must be a pretty hardcore food culture there.
Yeah, well, but I think what you have to do is look at the traditions of the two, because if you look at Chicago, I mean, their food history is the stockyards and the, you know, the industrialization of meat. And but I think, you know, in the past 10 years, there has been more of a movement towards local and sustainable. My friend Rob Levitt is doing a Butcher and Martyr in Chicago, which is a very similar concept to ours. But in New Orleans, you look at the history, and you have all the independent seafood guys bringing in the shrimp, the oysters, all this stuff, and people are actually a little bit more used to getting their food personally from somebody. We have seafood guys at the farmers markets here, which is just amazing. Mm-hmm. You know,
now,
and other products like rice, where it's like you never really think about getting rice directly from the farmer, but we can do it here from the farmers market. So I think that's really helped us out, and thankfully there was, you know, not as much of a meat scene, so that we were able to move into that niche.
Now, has the closing of the New York New Orleans Times Picayune and the loss of the food section, and our common friend, we have a common contact, the former editor of the food section there, or the restaurant reviewer there, has that had a negative effect on you guys opening and a negative effect on the food scene in general?
I think people were a little upset at first about it, but we've really, with the Times-Picayune and the staff that's still there, for example, Judy Walker wrote an amazing article about us the day before we opened, which definitely brought a great crowd in. They're also doing a lot of the online business, and I think a lot of people are starting to warm up to that as well. In addition, there's weekly magazines like The Gambit. There's a monthly magazine, Where You At? And they've kind of also really been receptive to what we're doing and have all been putting articles in about us and talking about us. But mostly everything we're doing is word of mouth and Twitter and Facebook.
Hmm.
Yeah, social media has been huge for us. I think, you know, kind of the void that the Times-Picayune left when they went to the semi-weekly format has been filled with all the independents doing some social media. You know, Twitter and Facebook is just huge for them.
So tell us what the greatest challenge was. I'll pose the question to each of you, and tell us your role at the place too. So give us a quick answer of the greatest challenge of opening or running the shop up until this point.
Okay, well, I'll take that one first. So I'm more of the numbers, the finance, the logistics guy. So, you know, my challenge has been, you know, trying to create systems that we can work as efficiently as possible in the shop. I mean, we're taking a business that really hasn't existed in this form for 50 years and trying to bring it into the computer age.
Huh.
So I've been trying to develop like a computerized tracking system, which you know, for most places, you take in one unit of something, you sell one unit of something, you know, and you can just track it that way. Well, we take in one animal and sell an infinite combination of products out the door. So finding an effective way to track that and manage our costs on that has been a big challenge and something that we're constantly refining.
Mm. And Simone?
For me, I think the biggest challenge was finding farmers that really were raising animals according to our standards, you know, very sustainable practices. And so I spent pretty much the entire summer going to visit farms. You know, I'd find a farmer, I'd be like, okay, well, let me go visit you because I want to make sure that I can honestly tell my customers, this is how your animal was raised. Hmm. These were the conditions. This is the processing facility. And then also getting the word out, just constantly networking with people and constantly getting people to know that we're serious about this and that we're going to bring a quality product. And I think we're definitely executing it. Well, the way we need to be.
You do have a nice way on the phone, Simone. You called. Of all the new people that call for turkeys, everyone was like at the office, oh, this is Simone. She sounds really nice. You should go. We should call her back. Because, you know, we always make it hard for new buyers because everyone calls, oh, let me get a turkey, blah, blah, blah. And we're like, oh, let's see if they're really interested. But we couldn't deny Simone's phone charm. So it was very, very interesting. I this is a weird question. I've never really asked this before, but whoever's the best person at describing visuals with words, describe the store to people, and then, you know, we'll give a website and everything. But what do people see when they walk in? What was the design element? It's a tough question for radio, but...
Well, when you walk in, it's a very open space. We want to make sure everything is transparent as possible because... Obviously, if something's hidden, why is it hidden? You don't want to go into a butcher shop and have them go in a back room and then where'd your meat really come from? We also have a reach-in cooler and freezer, like I said before, that has the sausages and stocks and meatballs and meat pies and beef offal and pork offal. And then we had a handmade counter, which is absolutely gorgeous, by a local carpenter in town. And you just go to the counter and you kind of let, you know, either Seth or I or any of our butchers let us know what we can do to help you. And then the butchers will come out and say you order a pork chop, we'll pull out the entire primal and bring it to you and say, how thick would you like it cut? And they cut it right there.
Hmm. Very, very cool. And how many employees do you have?
Currently, it's just the two of us, and then we have three butchers.
Wow, that's cool. Three butchers.
And Seth's wife also is here on Saturdays, and she's here right now manning the front so that we can talk to you. And I can say that this would not have been possible without her support. She's been absolutely amazing.
Oh, that's fantastic. So, well, give us your website and phone number and how people should contact you.
Okay, well, our website is cleaverand.co, cleaverand.co. And our phone number is 504-227-3830.
Well, we wish you the best of luck on behalf of all the turkey farmers that work so hard. We appreciate your purchase, and I know they thank you, too. And we hope you have a great Thanksgiving and much success in your awesome adventure.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Patrick, and I can't wait to one day, you know, meet you in person. And thanks again for all of your help. You've been amazing.
Oh, no,
yes,
please.
Thank you, Patrick.
We've done nothing. Anyway, you guys are great, and this has been a great, great show. Thanks to Scott Roberts for being on, and Simone Reggie and Seth Hampstead. Thanks to Joe Galarraga, and thanks to all the people, probably 40, 50 people, that helped get the turkeys safely to their final destination. One more wholesale delivery tomorrow and we'll be done. And then FedEx, of course, and then we get to eat, except for me, who has the turkey hotline wired to my cell phone, so I end up getting 20 calls of Thanksgiving. Anyway, well, for everyone else, though, have a great Thanksgiving, and thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Straight No Chaser.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.